This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
As parents, one of our biggest desires and challenges is for our children to be successful. The thing is, sometimes we can be real pains in the neck about it, and it's not helping.
Everybody is acting as if their child is in that far end of the bell curve, which is actually about 2-2.5% of kids who are very gifted.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of the book, Teach Your Children Well, and try to find out how understanding and support beats so-called hyperparenting any day of the week. We'll also spend an academic minute finding out what color the plants are on other worlds. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Sometimes you're going about your day and you're given a gift. You don't expect it, but there it is. This week, my gift was Madeline Levine. We had an interview scheduled to talk about her new book, Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success, Why Values and Coping Skills Matter More Than Grades, Trophies, or Fat Envelopes. What actually happened was Dr. Levine and I spent the better part of an hour on the phone talking about schools and parenting and dealing with kids in and out of school. Dr. Madeline Levine is a clinical psychologist with nearly 30 years' experience as a consultant and educator. She is the co-founder of Challenge Success, a project created at Stanford's School of Education. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. It seems like one of the main focuses of your new book is that we're measuring success the wrong way. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement. Well, I'd say it's more that we're only measuring success in a particular way and that there are many ways to measure success. So certainly one of them is grades and metrics and trophies and all of that, but that's just one.
But that seems to be the way a lot of people want to go. They want something tangible in their hand and say, okay, I did this, I've accomplished this.
Right. But the reality is, you know, there's a bell curve for all kinds of things, including the college you go to and the grades you get and what we call intelligence, although there are all different kinds of intelligence. And I think everybody is acting as if their child is in that far end of the bell curve, which is actually about 2-2.5% of kids who are very gifted, you know, and who belong at powerhouse schools and prestigious schools. But the reality is that most kids are not in that 2% or 2.5%. And I think we do a really inadequate job of helping those kids who, given every opportunity, can be just as successful. You know, there's a reason why the major CEOs in this country, the majority of them actually went to state schools. They didn't go to Ivy League schools. So there's a great Dimitri Martin cartoon that's a straight line, and it says, you know, this is what people think success looks like. And then he has this twisted, torturous line that says this is what it actually looks like. And, you know, I've been a psychologist for 30 years. My experience is that many people take twists and turns before they ultimately become successful, and that we don't help most kids. You know, I think we pressure our highly achieving students and we marginalize the majority of students with this narrow version of success.
Does it seem that it is a widespread problem that parents are just not seeing their children for who they are, just they want to see them for who they want them to be?
I do think it's widespread. You know, when I wrote The Price of Privilege about 5 years ago, I was looking at affluent kids because nobody had ever looked at their problems. And as a result of that, I sort of somehow got associated with, well, I'm about rich kids. But, you know, I've been traveling the country for the last 5 years or so, and I have this project at Stanford called Challenge Success. And we have about 100 schools. Half of them are public schools, half of them are private schools. Some of the public schools are basically inner city or everybody's on free lunch. I think most kids are on free lunch. I think that it is a problem that affects a wide swath of kids in this country.
In your book, you have sections for elementary school and middle school and high school. Do the parents need to go through those stages with their kids? Is it more important for them to go through it than the kids?
you know, Bob, it's sort of like you write a book about children, but if you read between the lines, you're really writing a book about parents.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And I think, you know, I think parents really are what's at issue here. The kids are at issue because their rates of emotional problems are so high. So we've got one in every four or five kids showing symptoms of depression, and suicide is up for the first time in decades, and cutting at the Ivy Leagues is at about 17%, and one out of four kids in college is a substance abuser, not a user. So kids are really suffering, you know, and you can't lay all of that at the feet of a narrow definition of success. There are many reasons for it. However, this does play a distinct role because kids who are pressured are more likely to fall into depression, et cetera, and have poorer coping skills. So things like cutting and substance abuse, well, we don't exactly think of it this way. They're actually attempts at coping, not healthy ones, but they are attempts at coping. And so I think what parents need to do is sort of make sure that what they're doing with their kids, as you said, you know, it's divided into chapters by age, make sure what they're doing with their kids is in line developmentally with what kids need so that we don't end up with kids who are so stressed out and really suffering. And I think that's hard to do because the whole culture is about, you know, more is better, faster is better. If my kid can read at four, that's a lot better than your kid who can read at seven. But in fact, it's not. It makes no difference if your child reads at four or at seven down the line. Kids go to these very academic preschools. All the research tells us that kids who actually go to play-based preschools do better down the line academically than kids who went to academic-based preschools. Probably the most popular video ever for kids was Baby Einstein, which supposedly advanced language acquisition, and in fact it retarded language acquisition. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of notions about what's good for kids. Unfortunately, a lot of them don't line up with the research we have.
I don't know if you have an answer for this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Does it get easier for a second child and then a third child after a parent has been through it once? Maybe they, you know, get better along the line?
That's an interesting question. Frankly, I think it can go either way. I think it might get easier because you have some perspective. So I have what I call three newly minted adult sons, you know, 20 to 30. One's in college, two are out in the work world. And I think the biggest thing that I've learned from having raised three sons was that in the middle of it all, man, do you lose perspective, you know? Like the things that I thought was so critical, a missed game, a poor grade, whatever it was, when your child is grown up, you look back and you can't believe that that's what you were worked up about. So I think having some experience helps because you realize parenting is not, we're not CEOs. We're not looking at the bottom line at the end of the quarter. You know, what's your grade today? What's your GPA today? We're looking, or we should be looking 20, 30 years out when our kids sort of grow up and enter the work world and become partners and have children of their own. So I think perspective, you know, if you've raised one child, you have some perspective. I think the reason it can go the other way is if that child has in some way disappointed you, not been the lawyer you thought he should be or the doctor you thought she should be, whatever, then I think some parents really ratchet up the pressure on the next kid. And that goes back to, you know, sort of what I think overparenting is. I think it's doing what your kid can do, doing what your kid can almost do for himself, and not knowing the difference between your needs and your child's needs. And it's that last one that's really toxic and I think can get activated. On a personal note, so my oldest son, who was, you know, the straight-A student and went to the top school and surprised became a lawyer, it made it a lot easier for my second kid, who is, like, really creative and lives in New York and does directing. That was easier for me, I think, than if my first kid had taken a more atypical path. So I think we can learn good things from having raised children in terms of perspective, but I think we're all vulnerable to using our children as ways of making up for our losses and our disappointments and, you know, what we wished we had done. And I think we have to watch out when we do that.
As parents, one of the first meetings you ever have with a teacher, they always tell you, we really want you to participate and don't hesitate to contact us if you have any questions or if you need some help. Has it gone too far? Are parents getting too involved in the day-to-day academic life of their children? Are we not just not letting them be independent?
I think in many cases we are. That goes back to, you know, if your kid knows how to do something, you don't belong in there. So if your child has pretty much mastered math, like, don't hang over them while they're doing their homework. You know what it's like to have somebody hanging over you, right? It's not good for your confidence. It's not good for your concentration. It's not good for your self-esteem. It's kind of like move on once your child has mastered something. And I think parents, I saw an article in The Atlantic entitled The Data-Driven Parent, Bob, and it was about how there are these apps and devices now that monitor absolutely every move, poop, tweet, whatever that your child makes from the day you bring it home from the hospital. And short of having something really wrong with your kid, this idea of constant surveillance of an infant is really creepy to me. Nobody does well under constant surveillance. All it does is raise, I think, parents' anxiety and make them, you know, more likely to be worried about things that are totally normal. Kids are very variable in how often they cry and, you know, pee and all kinds of things. So this kind of constant monitoring of every grade, this online stuff, even with my kids who are older, you could go online at any point in the day, and they used to call it Power School. I used to call it Power Snoop, and just see whether your kid took a test or missed a homework assignment or what their grade was that day. And no, teachers, you know, I have a lot of respect for teachers. That was my first profession, and the last thing they need with all the pressures that are on them between, you know, standardized testing and trying to stay vitally involved in the profession, they don't need a parent calling up and saying, you know, why'd my kid get an A- instead of an A or a B+ instead of an A-. We're not night teachers. Teachers are paid to be teachers. And there's a whole, like, there's this whole bunch of other things that kids need to develop well. So sometimes I think of it like as a three-legged stool. So a child has, you know, the academic cognitive leg, but they also have the social, and they also have the psychological and personal. And there's only 24 hours in a day. And so if all our time is spent, what'd you do, how'd you do, I'm going to talk to your teacher, what's your grade, did you study, have you done your homework, I think what happens is, you know, you may make that one leg bigger, but the other two legs, the social and the personal development, start to wither.
On the other hand, not every kid is an overstressed victim. Some of them need a kick in the butt.
Some of them need a kick in the butt. Well, you know, yes and no. So let's talk about that.
Okay.
You know, there are people who say, my kid is lazy, and they really do need a kick in the butt, as you said. So my take on that, often, having treated those kids for many years, is that often nobody's speaking their language. So my third child was a total hands-on learner. That's how he learned. And in an affluent suburb, there is nothing for those kinds of kids. So did he in some ways look like he wasn't trying all that hard? He probably did. He was trying, but he wasn't being spoken to in a language that he could really understand. So I think a lot of kids, because we're so narrow, because everything is verbal as opposed to creative or hands-on, and a guy named Sternberg, who was at Yale and then was at Tufts, it's the triarchic theory of intelligence. Kids either kind of learn analytically, creatively, or hands-on. So I think for a lot of those kids, we're just not speaking their language and providing them with opportunities to be successful in the things they're good at. Do kids sometimes get lazy? Of course. So here's the secret that I think all adults have from children. And that's that in real life, we're not perfect. We're not A students of life. We're not great at everything. And so, you know, I'm having a really good time talking to you, and it's easy for me to be verbal and talk. I've kept audiences of 2,000 people waiting because I can't find my way back from the bathroom 100 yards down the hall to the stage because my spatial relations are so bad. So I didn't become a surgeon, and I never did especially well in math. And I think kids who, you know, are pressured to be straight-A students and get perfect boards and stuff like that, it's a myth, and it's not the way life is when you go out into the world. You're lucky if you're good, really good, at one or two things. And, you know, at a whole bunch of things, we're kind of average. So we forget. I think because adolescence was so challenging, many of us forget what it was like, especially sort of middle school where, you know, you had no idea what body you were going to wake up to. It was like alien on a daily basis because things were growing all out of proportion. You know, you had the zits on your face. You didn't know if the girl next to you when she left was laughing at you or with you. You know, your friends one day weren't the next day. All of a sudden your parents were intolerable. Plus, you have to learn algebra, right? And so I think we forget that sometimes when kids are not doing their best, it's because they're struggling to accomplish other developmental tasks that at the end of the day will be just as important as whether or not they ace that particular course.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Madeline Levine continues with a look at or search for solutions. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1148. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest is Dr. Madeline Levine, author of the book Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success, Why Values and Coping Skills Matter More Than Grades, Trophies, or Fat Envelopes.
So what do we do? How do parents learn who their children are and what they're going to need?
Well, clearly, it seems to me, adults need to regain the role of parent as we've historically known it, which was there was always a parent-child differential with parents sort of doing parent things and children doing children things and parents kind of calling the shots, and I think we've lost that. There was always an emphasis on character, doing the chores, helping out, you know, being a good person. A lot of that's gone. It's like, oh, you have an AP chem test tomorrow? Go study. I'll clear the dishes. Mom's worked all day long, but she'll clear the dishes instead of her daughter or her son, which is, I think, a mistake. So I think we need to regain our role as parents. I think we have to make adulthood look attractive, and that means that we don't spend all week working our butts off and then the entire weekend watching our kids hit a ball around. So probably the most common line after 28 years of being a psychologist was, please tell my mother to get a hobby besides me. And I think a lot of us have lost that. We've lost the idea that it might be a much better way to spend a Saturday morning with a girlfriend, with our husband, on a hobby than it is to always be there at every child-centric activity. And finally, I think our kids do need to be very active participants in the house. I mean, I'm down by Silicon Valley. Every VC, every CEO says kids need to be collaborative going into the 21st century. And you know, a child's first, air quotes, workplace is their family. So they have to be taught, you know, to follow the rules, perseverance, grit, not interfered with when they make mistakes. We call them successful failures because this is how kids learn, is by making mistakes. Not the end of the world, picking themselves up again and finding that it builds resilience.
We started this by asking if we're measuring success in the wrong way. I guess we'll end it just asking, should we be measuring at all?
That's a great question. Should we be measuring at all? So, you know, I think measuring within a child's own capacity can be helpful. Kids, and I want to put this in a developmental framework, so young kids don't compare themselves at all. There is no point in measuring a 6 or a 7-year-old because they don't see it that way. That's why your 7-year-olds believe that they're going to be Major League Baseball players because they don't have any sense of comparison, and it's a short gift of childhood, and I think we leave that alone. Older kids start comparing themselves in earnest to each other. They really do want to know how they're doing. And I think it reminds me of the old days when I went to school, you know, half my report card was academic and the other half was character, was plays well with others, respects the rights of others, follows instructions. And I think we would do well to rethink making character and coping skills a basic part of education again.
Dr. Madeline Levine is a clinical psychologist with nearly 30 years' experience as a consultant and educator. She is also co-founder of Challenge Success from Stanford's School of Education. You can learn more about Dr. Levine at madelinelevine.com. Ever hear the expression, what color is the sky in your world? Well, we might not have the answer to that, but it looks like we can tell you what the color of the plants are. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Even if your vision is perfect, there are many frequencies of light you just can't see. But as Nancy King of Columbia University's Earth Institute explains, such invisible light is far from useless to a newly discovered species of plant life, and the implications are out of this world.
As kids, we learn that we get the oxygen we breathe from green plants because they do photosynthesis. They get carbon from carbon dioxide, CO2, and they do this using sunlight to split water molecules. The oxygen we breathe comes from the H2O. And all the hundreds of thousands of species of plants, and algae, and cyanobacteria, all use the same one pigment to obtain that light energy, chlorophyll A. Chlorophyll A preferentially absorbs blue and red light, and just a tad less green, so we see plants as green. Scientists used to think that chlorophyll A must be essential for splitting water for photosynthesis because it was the only known pigment doing it, and the blue through red photons have just high enough energy per photon to do the task. But there's one organism that's different from all the others. It's a recently discovered cyanobacterium named Acaria chloris marina, and it's replaced chlorophyll A with a variation called chlorophyll D. Chlorophyll D absorbs photons way out in the far red and near infrared, photons that have less energy than visible light and are left over by chlorophyll A organisms. Acaria chloris lives in that leftover light niche where there isn't much visible light, but it's splitting water and doing photosynthesis just fine. And guess what? Its light niche looks a lot like what we might see on planets that orbit red dwarf stars. So, in the search for life elsewhere in the universe, NASA's planet-finding telescopes will be designed to look for atmospheric oxygen and chlorophyll D-like pigments adapted to those alien light environments. What else? Since chlorophyll D allows Acaria chloris to use 18% more of the solar spectrum, maybe we could use it to improve crop productivity or to harness more solar energy. So, this little cyanobacterium is helping us both look for life in outer space and find out things that can improve life here back home. Now that's pretty far out.
That was Nancy King of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.